Coon Review, Print Speaking to the Blind, celebrating 40 years of audio newspaper production. Welcome to this week's edition of the National Podcast, recorded at the Bishop Briggs Media Centre by our amazing volunteers. You can get in touch with us via Facebook, Twitter or Instagram using @CoonReview, that is @CUEANDREVIEW. You can also contact us directly by emailing information@coonreview.com. That is information@CUEANDREVIEW.com. Or by calling 0141-772-3976. That's 0141-772-3976.
This is from The National on Friday, the 26th of January, 2024, from the news section. Fake Scottish hospital surgeon jailed for cruel lies. This article is written by Andy Hamilton. A serial charlatan who conned a grieving family after gaining access to restricted areas at a busy Scottish hospital by pretending to be a surgeon has been jailed for his cruel lies. Anthony Adams befriended the family of a man who died in a motorcycle accident and concocted a series of heartbreaking stories which led to him being asked to help carry the man's coffin. A court heard the Walter Mitty figure was unable to offer any explanation for the unimaginable distress he caused as a result of his fantasies. The 29-year-old appeared in the dock for sentencing this week after pleading guilty last year to a charge of breaching the peace, the Ardrossan Herald reports. Adams of Princes Street in Ardrossan, who was previously convicted of impersonating a Celtic FC scout at youth football matches in Cummock and Largs, managed to get hold of a staff pass giving him access to restricted areas at Crosshouse Hospital in Ayrshire between April 30th and May 14th, 2021. He also admitted falsely telling a woman that her late son had become a dad before her death, gaining access to her home, family and friends, and got her to give him a role at her son's funeral. That offence was committed between July the 3rd and October the 14th the same year. Kilmarnock Sheriff Court heard that NHS chiefs had re-examined their security measures at Crosshouse after Adams's deception raised significant concerns. The Procurator Fiscal Depute said Adams had been an inpatient at the Stoma Care Unit at Crosshouse on April 21st. And that while talking to patients in a smoking area, he had told them, "I'm a doctor on sick leave for 6 months." The prosecutor said that on May the 14th, Adams had returned to the hospital in civilian clothes, before going into a disabled toilet and then accessing a linen room, where he was able to get hold of a blue scrubs and an NHS ID badge. He was eventually rumbled after a stoma nurse who had previously cared for Adams encountered him and asked him what he was doing, to which he replied he was working today and added, "in the theatres." The fiscal deputy continued, "She was unaware of him being an employee and, after becoming concerned, she contacted the relevant department." When challenged, he said he had qualifications at the University of California and had travelled all over the world treating patients typhoid and malaria. Security staff confronted Adams and asked why he was pretending to be a doctor, and he showed them a prescription pad and insisted that he was. Police attended the hospital and, after noting there was a warrant out for Adams' arrest, took him to Kilmarnock Police Station. He was told he would be the subject of a report to the fiscal and replied, "Okay." The fiscal then went on to describe how Adams had contacted the sister of the man who had died in a motorbike crash, claiming to know her brother. The crash victim, the court heard, had died at the Queen Elizabeth University Hospital, QEUH, after initially being taken to Crosshouse. On July the 14th, the fiscal continued, the accused messaged the witness, inquiring about visiting her mother's home. It was agreed, and he attended. The witness still did not recognize the accused, who said he had stayed at the house before. The witness felt this was strange, but gave him the benefit of the doubt. He talked about her brother's treatment and said he should have been transferred to the QEUH earlier. He later said he was a doctor and could prescribe her sleeping medication, which she declined. She thought this was a bit strange to be offered in this manner. He asked if she could request his medical records so he could look over them. The accused went outside for a smoke and told the witness her brother's last words were, "Please don't let me die," and that he was going to be a dad again. This made her upset and she informed her mother. Adams later claimed that he'd raised £1,000 from his family, friends and colleagues to give to the man's loved ones, but the cash never materialised. Adams, the court heard, was asked to be a pallbearer at the crash victim's funeral and then claimed to be setting up a memorial bench at the beach at Ardrossan. He told the family he'd had a memorial canvas created, but this was never seen. The fiscal deputy added, after becoming suspicious, they searched for his name on Google. They read on a news website about him pretending to be a Celtic scout and stealing money. They felt alarmed, having welcomed him into their home and taken him at face value. They contacted Adams's brother, asking about the accused, who said he knew nothing. They contacted the accused by text message, who did reply, apologising, but left the complainers angry and distraught. Sentencing on Adams had been deferred for a psychiatric report, but defence solicitor Sandy Curry said that report did not make the situation a great deal clearer. "It appears to me, entering the area of amateur psychology, to be some kind of grandiose scheme in his head," Curry continued. "He certainly has a great knowledge of medical matters." Over a period, he was gravely ill. He seems to have become enthralled with the whole medical situation, learned about it, then sort of deluded himself he can insinuate himself into situations. Asked by Sheriff Laurel Mundell how Adams could explain getting hold of NHS scrubs and an ID pass, Curry said, "I seriously wish I could give an explanation." Turning to Adams's deceit of the crash victim's family, Curry said his client did know the man, but that he greatly exaggerated his position to the family. When Sheriff Mundell asked what on earth would motivate such a cruel lie, Mr. Curry said, "I cannot do anything other than guess. There's a theme here. He wanted to be more important than he is." Sheriff Mundell told Adams this was a catalogue of serious, fraudulent offending for a prolonged period and with no explanation. "The alarm and distress you caused to the family is unimaginable. There can be no appropriate sentence other than a period of imprisonment." Adams was jailed for 6 months, reduced from 8 because of his plea of guilty. That article was written by Andy Hamilton. This is from The National on Friday, the 26th of January, 2024, from the news section. First Minister's questions. Humza Yousaf mocks Tory MSP after she calls rent cap a disaster. That article is written by Steph Braun. Humza Yousaf tore into a Tory MSP after she claimed the Scottish Government's rent cap had been nothing short of a disaster. In October 2022, emergency legislation was passed to freeze private rents in Scotland. It was then amended to allow a 3% rent increase in a 12-month period, with landlords able to apply for a 6% increase where they could prove that the increase was needed. That legislation is set to expire in April after a number of extensions, with Tenants' Rights Minister Patrick Harvey having announced plans to temporarily change the rent adjudication process until April 1, 2025. Tory MSP Pam Gosal attacked the Scottish Government at First Minister's questions, saying the rent cap had exacerbated the housing emergency. She said, "The SNP green rent cap has not only failed to tackle the housing emergency, but it has exacerbated it. Rents in Scotland have increased by more than 14%, despite the rent cap, and Scotland is the only part of the UK where the numbers of properties sold by landlords have gone up. It has caused enormous price hikes when people do move and has reduced the availability of housing by driving landlords out of the market." She added it had been nothing short of a disaster and asked him if he would scrap the cap. But the First Minister hit back and said, "My goodness, I think that is the most conservative contribution I have ever heard in this chamber." Mocking her contribution, Youssef added, "How dare the Scottish Government interfere in the middle of a UK government cost of living crisis to help tenants because of the economic damage they've, the UK government, caused? How dare we have the temerity to protect renters because of the economic vandalism of Pam Gosal's party? Her contribution doesn't bear the reality. The latest Scottish landlord register data shows the number of registered properties for rent in Scotland between August 2022 and November 2023 has actually increased. I will never make an apology for making sure we are on the right side of this argument." That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday the 26th of January 2024. From the Culture section. Martin Compston to star in Top Director's Glasgow Godfather film. This article is written by Rebecca Newlands. A top director has revealed plans to make a Glasgow Godfather film starring Martin Compston. John S. Baird, whose work includes Filth, starring James McAvoy, is currently working on a script for a picture based on the city's criminal underworld. He is keen for Line of Duty star Compston to feature in it, and admitted that fellow Scottish stars Dougray Scott and Tony Curran are keen to be involved. Speaking on Compston's Restless Natives podcast, Baird said, "I have always wanted to do something in Scotland again, but on a big scale and get everybody together. Myself and Gregory Burke, a really great Scottish writer, have just started writing a script. It's based on the Glasgow underworld, but it's a Scottish version of The Godfather. It's tasty. I was at the BAFTA Scotland Awards, and I literally whispered to one person, 'We're going to be doing this Scottish Godfather.' Half an hour later, I had Dougray and Tony Curran up at me, going, 'What's all this?'" He added, "There is an array of Scottish talent, and I want to get everybody in. This is the first time I have talked about it, and I'm so excited about it. We have written the first outline, and we are talking to film companies and studios now. There's a lot of interest in it." That article was written by Rebecca Newlands. This is from The National on Friday the 26th of January, 2024. From the News section. Rwanda. European judge warns UK government not to ignore court orders. This article is written by Laura Pollock. Rishi Sunak has been warned he will be breaking European human rights law if his UK government ignores emergency court orders intended to stop asylum seekers being sent to Rwanda. The Prime Minister has repeatedly vowed not to let foreign courts block the plan to send some migrants on a one-way trip to the African nation. The Safety of Rwanda Asylum and Immigration Bill, going through Parliament, states that it is up to ministers to decide whether or not to comply with interim rulings issued by judges in the European Court of Human Rights. But the Strasbourg Court's president, Siofra O'Leary, said, there is a clear legal obligation under the European Convention on Human Rights, ECHR, for states to comply with the so-called Rule 39 interim measures. A Rule 39 measure, branded a pajama injunction by critics because it can be issued outside normal court hours, contributed to the 2022 grounding of the first flight intended to take asylum seekers to Rwanda under the government's controversial scheme. The new legislation going through Parliament seeks to address the legal challenges which has dogged the scheme and states that ministers have the power to ignore such rulings. But O'Leary told a press conference, there is a clear legal obligation under the Convention for states to comply with Rule 39 measures. She said the interim measures are only issued in exceptional circumstances where there is a real and imminent risk of irreparable harm. Countries which have failed to comply with Rule 39 indications have previously been found to have violated obligations under Article 34 of the ECHR, which gives the right for individuals to apply to the court once domestic legal routes have been exhausted. Senior Judge O'Leary said the UK has always complied with Rule 39 measures, except in one very particular case, and has publicly declared the need for other states to comply with Rule 39 indications, including urging Vladimir Putin's Russia to abide by a 2021 measure in relation to the release of opposition leader Alexei Navalny. The Strasbourg court presidents would not be drawn on the Safety of Rwanda bill while it goes through the parliamentary process. But she said, I know there's a very healthy debate in the United Kingdom relating to the content of the bill. It's a country which is blessed with many, many international legal experts and a very active civil society. So I am sure that all of these issues can be fully examined. In the Rwanda case in June 2022, the interim measure blocking an Iraqi asylum seeker being sent to the African state was granted just hours before the flight was due to take off. O'Leary said Rule 39 measures are almost always sought in situations of urgency, if not extreme urgency, and the nature of the urgency or the degree of urgency is something which respondent governments control. The interim injunction powers are rarely used. In 2023, 13 requests were refused, and just one interim measure was granted. The Rule 39 process is currently being reformed, and since December 2023, the duty judge issuing an interim measure will be identified, addressing one of the criticisms of the situation in the Rwanda case. That article was written by Laura Pollock. This is from The National on Friday the 26th of January 2024, from the news section. UK COVID inquiry. Humza Yousaf apologises for handling of WhatsApp messages. This article is written by Steph Braun. The First Minister has offered an unreserved apology for the poor handling of requests for WhatsApp messages by the Scottish Government at the UK COVID inquiry. Humza Yousaf, who served as Health Secretary during the pandemic, insisted there was no excuse for the deletion of the messages by top politicians and officials, adding that the government should have done better. The inquiry heard last week that former First Minister Nicola Sturgeon appeared to have retained no messages whatsoever, though she later clarified the inquiry does have copies of her informal messages. The hearing in Edinburgh was also told that her then-deputy John Swinney's WhatsApp messaging was set to auto-delete. Jamie Dawson, KC, had put it to Yousaf that it was important for the material relating to the way in which decisions were taken to be retained, so that lessons could be learned and a better response to the pandemic be developed. Yousaf said that was correct and added, on this issue of informal messages, including WhatsApps, Let me unreservedly apologize to this inquiry, but also to those who are mourning the loss of a loved one by COVID, for the government's frankly poor handling of the various Rule 9 requests in relation to informal messaging. There's no excuse for it. We should have done better, and it's why I reiterate that public apology today. Yousaf had earlier in the day made the same apology in the Holyrood Chamber at First Minister's Questions. He went on to say that there was an awareness among ministers that government business should be recorded in the corporate record, but for a long time the organisational mindset of the government had been that as long as the corporate body had all the salient points, that was all that was required. Yousaf said, "There is clearly a gap that exists in relation to how informal material should be retained." He announced during FMQs that he had commissioned an externally led review into the use of mobile messaging apps and the use of non-corporate technology in the Scottish Government. That article was written by Steph Braun. This is from The National on Friday, the 26th of January, 2024, from the comments section. Yes for EU to host interactive workshop on securing Scottish membership. This article is written by Laura Pollock. This weekend, Yes for EU will host a very interesting event. The EU is enlarging. How can Scotland join in? It comes as the European Union has talked of growth in recent months. In September, European Commission President Ursula von der Leyen told the body that it must immediately prepare for radical changes needed for Ukraine and other countries to become members of the bloc in the face of Russian aggression. At the event, there will be input from Dr. Kirsty Hughes and Councillor Heather Anderson, a former MEP, who will explain what an association agreement is and what benefits Scotland could expect from having an association agreement during the time between Independence Day and the implementation of the full EU Treaty of Accession. The event is to be held on Saturday, January the 27th at 1:30 p.m. until 4 p.m. at Augustine United Church in Edinburgh. The event is also an interactive workshop, and attendees will be invited to watch short videos, read relevant paragraphs in the Scottish Government's Building a New Scotland reports, and debate different aspects of the accession process. Last week, Believe in Scotland, BIS, launched its mass survey of the independence movement for 2024. And already more than 2,200 independence supporters have responded. This annual survey seeks to act as a temperature check for grassroots activists and the wider movement, gauging its feelings on progress to independence, political parties, campaigning, and issues such as the EU. Founder of BIS, Gordon McIntyre Kemp, said that last year's poll found 97% of no to yes switchers want an independent Scotland to become a member of the EU. He added, "A lot has changed since our last mass survey in January 2023. That's why this poll is so important, to find out what the grassroots independence movement thinks on where independence stands today, after a change in First Minister, police investigations, a more aggressive UK government, and the political parties have a tricky general election to navigate." McIntyre Kemp said that the survey is vital to find out where the independence movement stands on big campaigning issues and encouraged everyone to complete and share the form to ensure accurate campaign materials that reflect the current mood of the nation. "If you are an independence activist or supporter, then I would really encourage you to fill out the survey," he added. "We've had a really good response so far, and we need to know what you think." Amid the chaos and the media spin of the COVID inquiry, we reported yesterday that the UK government is threatening to tighten up civil service rules on reserved and devolved issues, and this could have a knock-on effect for future independence papers published by the Scottish Government. Despite civil servants in Scotland having a responsibility to deliver the Scottish Government's policies, a UK Government spokesperson said that the principle of a single civil service across the UK must be maintained, and that officials in Scotland are answerable to the Cabinet Secretary in Whitehall. George Fulkes, the Labour peer spearheading the tightening of the rules, said, "Swift action is needed to stop spending on a Minister for Independence, his support staff, pretend embassies and other reserved areas, when the money could be redirected to devolved areas which are being starved of resources." Elsewhere, a major new poll shows that a majority of Scots back Holyrood having the powers to negotiate and legislate for independence. The survey, carried out by Find Out Now on behalf of the ALBA party, found nearly 6 in 10 Scots, 57.5%, agree or strongly agree with the proposal, excluding don't knows. Around a third said they did not back the idea, with 10.8% saying they disagreed and 22% saying they strongly disagreed. That article was written by Laura Pollock.
This is from The National on Monday, 29th January 2024, from the Politics section. German firm aims for monthly rocket launches from Shetland Islands. By James Walker. A German firm hopes to launch rockets into space as often as once a month from the island at the northernmost tip of the UK. Rocket factory Augsburg, or RFA's, chief commercial officer said excitement is building ahead of their Olympic gold medal moment this summer when they will try to achieve Europe's first ever launch delivering satellites into orbit. The company is one of several planning to use launch pads at Saxavord Spaceport on the island of Unst, the most northerly of the Shetland Islands. In December, Saxavord was granted the UK's first vertical launch spaceport licence, allowing up to 30 launches each year. Jørn Spurman spoke to the PA news agency about RFA's plans for the first launch of their RFA-1 launcher, a 30-metre-tall, three-stage rocket which can deliver a 1,300-kilogram payload to a sun-synchronous orbit around Earth. He said, "Everything looks positive for the first launch taking place in the summer, but much will depend on their testing process." Spurman said, "We plan to be on pad in the summer and start the testing campaign. Then we have an anticipated first launch attempt and we see how it goes." He added, "We have on the Shetland Islands a dedicated launch pad purely for RFA, so there's no time pressure for us." He said people on Unst, which has a population of around 600, were supportive of the project, saying, "The locals, they pretty much realise what a big opportunity it is for them." After testing in Germany and elsewhere, the various components of the rocket and its cargo of satellites will be shipped to Lerwick in around a dozen containers before being driven north to Unst. Spurman said, "We do a full assembly and check out testing in Augsburg. Then we put it in a dozen containers, roughly. Then the final remating of these stages and encapsulation of the fairing, final testing, all that happens on site at the launch pad. A hot test of the rocket's first stage engines at the launch pad is expected in the months ahead of the first flight. Ultimately, RFA wants to reuse the lower stages of its rockets in order to generate savings, similar to the Falcon series of rockets used by Elon Musk's SpaceX. While this will not take place in the initial flights, the first stage of the RFA-1 rocket will be parachuted back to splashdown in the sea after propelling the upper parts of the vehicle high into the atmosphere. The 9 helix engines on the lower part of the rocket make up the bulk of the vehicle's cost. Spoorman said, "We are planning mid-term to get to a launch cadence of once a year, so 12 a year. That should happen over 3 years. Then it really depends where the market is. If the market needs more, we have flexibility to do more." RFA's team of about 300 people will see the first successful launch as an Olympic gold medal moment, Mr. Spoorman said, as the project has been years in the making. However, if the attempt ends in failure, he said RFA would be ready with a second vehicle as soon as possible for another try. Last year, RFA's British subsidiary received £3.5 million from the UK Space Agency to support its launch plans. That article was by James Walker. This is from The National on Monday, 29th January 2024, from the News section. Scottish business profits outstripping UK average, figures show. By Gregor Young. Sales and profits in Scotland outstripped the UK average in the final quarter of last year, the latest figures have shown. Scotland bucked the UK trend of slowing domestic sales growth, with an annual rate of 5% reported in fourth quarter versus a UK rate of 3.6%, with the higher rate expected to continue in the coming year. Export sales in Scotland were also up on the year before and are set to grow at a faster pace than anywhere in the UK. As a result of rising selling prices and strong domestic sales, Scottish businesses achieved profits growth of 3.3%, outstripping the UK average. Again, this looks set to continue, with profits growth expected to reach 5.3% in Scotland over the next 12 months, compared to 4.6% for the UK. Scottish firms also said they expected salary and employment growth in the year ahead to be amongst the highest in the UK. However, as measured by the Business Confidence Monitor produced by the ICAEW accountancy body, sentiment in Scotland fell to 2 in the final 3 months of 2023, down from 6.4% in the previous quarter. This suggests Scottish firms are less confident about their prospects than those elsewhere in the UK. The ICAEW also said Scottish companies reported a growing number of challenges. The majority of businesses said they were struggling with consumer demand, although these concerns eased in the fourth quarter and the issue is more prevalent elsewhere in the UK. Cost pressures are set to reduce in the coming year, although at a slower rate than the UK average. Overall, capital investment spending in Scotland in 2023 was among the highest in the UK and is set to grow faster than anywhere else over the coming year. Firms in Scotland continue to raise their research and development budgets, and although this is expected to moderate in the coming year, the projected rate of increase keeps Scotland among the top performers in the UK. ICAEW Director for Scotland, David Bond, said, "With economic concerns continuing to weigh on Scottish businesses, the Business Confidence Monitor presents a mixed picture, with sentiment down, although still positive, and strong sales and profits growth, which is set to continue. Nevertheless, Scottish companies say they face a range of challenges, with the majority of our firms devoting too much time and energy to regulatory requirements." That article was by Gregor Young.
The National, recorded on Monday, 29th of January 2024. The Culture Section. Review, Jekyll and Hyde at Royal Lyceum in Edinburgh, by James Walker, multimedia journalist. Who can doubt that Robert Louis Stevenson's iconic 1886 novella, The Strange Case of Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde, was inspired not only by the legal case of his Edinburgh acquaintance, the French teacher Eugène Chantrel, who was hanged in 1878 for murdering his young wife Elizabeth by poisoning, but also by the architecture and history of Edinburgh's old town. The famous story of the upstanding medic Dr. Henry Jekyll and his demonic alter ego Edward Hyde may be set in London, but it reverberates with the Gothic atmosphere of the ancient district of Scotland's capital that sits to the south of Edinburgh Castle and the Royal Mile. Where better, then, for the superb Scottish actor Forbes Mason to perform Gary McNair's stage adaptation, in a production created originally for Reading Rep Theatre in Berkshire, than at Edinburgh's great repertory theatre, the Royal Lyceum. Aided only by a microphone and a chair, Mason, performing in the Lyceum stage for the first time in 20 years, evokes brilliantly the intrigue, concern and horror felt by Jekyll's friend, the lawyer, Gabriel John Utterson. At the outset, employing a sardonic wit that's typical of McNair's supple and lively script, Utterson assures us that he's not the good guy of the story he's about to tell. He's not the villain either, you understand. But as the kind of man who enjoys a good brandy in a gentleman's club immediately after successfully defending a murderer in court, Utterson isn't making any claims to moral superiority. This is a good point well made, and one to which, in a clever philosophical dialogue between McNair's text and Stevenson's novella, we return later in the play. Max Jones's set, entirely dark save for lighting designer Richard Howell's purposeful illumination using modernistic white neon strobes, provides Mason with a perfect abstract void, a kind of theatrical canvas on which the actor paints theatrical pictures. This he does through his dexterous, captivating expression of a text that combines excellent dramatic storytelling with a pleasing amalgam of the linguistic registers of McNair and Stevenson. More than that, however, as the actor-narrator shifts between the story's various characters, his physical performance puts one in mind of the solo shows of such celebrated monodramatists as Guy Masterson and Stephen Berkoff. When near the play's conclusion, we finally encounter the two-in-one human paradox that is Jekyll transforming into Hyde. Mason proves to have a memorable and impressive capacity for paroxysm. As, assisted by Richard Hamerton's atmospheric music and sound, Mason's Utterson takes us ever deeper into Stevenson's story, one finds oneself caught up anew in the question of metaphysics, science and morality that fascinated the Victorians and continue to fixate us now in the 21st century. Simultaneously entertaining and disquieting, director Michael Fentiman's stylish, drum-tight production is set to delight audiences in its short tour to Tayside in Stirlingshire, touring Perth Theatre Jan 31 to Feb 3, Dundee Rep Feb 7 to 10, and McRoberts Arts Centre, University of Stirling, Feb 15 to 17, by James Walker. The National, recorded on Monday, 29th of January 2024. The Culture Section. Review, Verse Novels' Delicate Handling of Trauma, by Gemma E. McLaughlin. Novels in verse take two forms, poetry and the novel, and draw them together. With each poem, a long-form story is advanced with an engaging rhythm. I was introduced to this style by its growing fame in the young adult world, from the witty magic of these poetic authors such as Dean Atta and the Black Flamingo. In 2021, C.G. Moore released Gut Feelings, a full and detailed coming-of-age exploration of how it is to be diagnosed and live with chronic illness as a young person. While an entirely separate story, this latest novel in verse from Moore seems to carry something similar, a matured and dark honesty that never ceases to feel like a necessity. The ambiguity of the form of poetry itself, its vagueness and twists, the most simple words sticking in the mind, and metaphors slipping from, then coming back into grasp, fits this narrative's themes perfectly. Trigger tells the story of a 17-year-old boy named Jay, once happy and carefree, but after having been to a club with his boyfriend Jackson the night before, he has only the memory of him leaving before everything becomes blurry, blocked by what he learns is trauma. After being told he has been sexually assaulted, the poems are told in parts from that initial discovery to the search for justice. Jay becomes obsessed with what he does not know. The writing handles with care an empathetic manipulation of these two contrasting forms, the equally opposite feelings of denial and fear around the events which change us and the desperate desire for knowledge of every detail and therefore a sense of control. While Jay handles the reactions of those around him, from best friend and family members and their protectiveness to the vicious rumours of unkind classmates, more and more details are revealed. While there is both narrative and character satisfaction in this structure, the story of what happened to Jay and how he can stop the men involved from doing it again does not feel like a mystery. Beyond this element, what truly matters in Trigger is a story of healing and awareness. Loosely inspired by the writer's own experiences, he made the choice to face something difficult and taboo, boldly pushing forward with an honesty about male mental health and sexual assault. While toxic standards of masculinity press on with the notion that power comes from silence, Trigger is unapologetically loud. It feels like the release of a scream and the arms of loving parents and friends wrapping you in safety all at once. Jay's story is one that resonates, one that does not leave. It is a truthfully messy, angry, sad, hopeful guide to the process of healing that could mean the world to any young person who's been through something like him. It's a story which would do well in schools and sex ed classes, but equally in the corners of bedrooms and in the hands of friends. By Gemma E. McLaughlin, The National, recorded on Monday, 29th of January, 2024. The Culture Section. Travel. Travel to Scottish borders and you'll be filled with optimism. By Robin McElvey, travel writer. Sometimes the Tweed fills me with sadness. Sadness at the thought of Edward I rampaging through Berwick-upon-Tweed, massacring thousands of Scots and stealing the major Scottish port in 1296. Today, though, I'm filled with optimism as I cross the stately 1820s wrought iron Union chain bridge back into Scotland, as I've heard the Berwickshire coast is on the up. A cheery sign welcomes me to the Scottish borders, and immediately a wee trail snakes along the river as they leave England behind. My first stop at Paxton House is filled with Jacobite intrigue, which guide Jim Casey surprises me with. Just as fascinating are the impressive collection of more than 100 Chippendale pieces, paintings by Raeburn and Wilkie on loan from the National Gallery, and an outrageous collage of costumes, immaculately preserved from when the owner attended the court of Frederick the Great. Nearby Eyemouth is a Scottish borders town that I normally either dash past on the A1 or nip into for fish and chips in the waterfront. This time I'm quickly ensconced for 2 nights at the cosy family-run Home Arms, which has been welcoming weary travellers since the 19th century. Eyemouth's history, of course, dates back far longer as the port for the religious community at Coldingham, then as a port stand-in for Berwick after the 1296 sacking. Today the deep-sea trawler fleet has been trimmed back as the promised Brexit bonanza has failed to materialise. Ewan Scott of the Eyemouth Harbour Trust remains positive. We're seeing a boom in the smaller boats fishing for things like crab, prawn and lobster, and we're putting a lot of effort into looking at ways to develop the harbour and its surrounds for the good of the community, as well as stakeholders. Eyemouth has had its fair share of knocks over the years, no more tragic than the violent storm in October 1881 that swept 129 Eyemouth men to their deaths, and more souls from the surrounding villages, many within sight of their desperate families. Fittingly, the striking bronze sculpture by the beach is titled Widows and Bairns. As my search for optimism threatens to grind to a mournful halt, I chance upon Retweed. This social enterprise is a breath of fresh community air. We're here to offer local women the chance to learn traditional skills for free and to give them opportunities, beams Retweed's Maggie McCall. We welcome visitors to weekend classes too, whose proceeds are funneled back into the free classes. We've got big plans for the future to really help the wider community and bring in as many people as possible. I'm impressed by the passion of Retweed and also their creations for sale, such as colourful tartan purses and elegant cushions. One cushion catches my eye. That is the Berwickshire tartan, explains McCall. It was created by International Tartans for the stately Union chain bridge marking the entrance into Scotland, Eyemouth Harbour hiding delicious fishy feasts and sister initiative to democratise tartan. More than 100 tartans have been officially registered, for everyone from US states to African countries onto the Samaritans. The latter's design is called Samaritartan. I lose my first Eyemouth day talking to people in the wee shops and businesses that dot the centre of the old fishing village.
The wee nooks and crannies were ideal for smugglers trying to evade the authorities too, as I learned at Gunn's Greenhouse. Surely the cheekiest grand house in Scotland was commissioned by John Napier so he could run his merchant business, which involved working his way around the 119% tax on tea. Gunn's Green is a quite brilliant building, alive with secret doors, hidden holes, and even the multi-floor tea shoot. Adam's architectural creation is currently being revamped, but you can still pop along for one-off events such as themed afternoon teas. You can stay in the characterful old bedrooms too, a thrilling historic experience that also offers great views of the town back across the Lifeblood Harbour. You can also follow the 20-stop, 3-kilometre-long Smuggler's Trail. There is no hiding away in a smuggler's cave surviving on salty scraps for me during my few days in Eyemouth. At the ship, I feast on steamed mussels, then a lemon-infused local prawn risotto. At Rialto Coffee Co., I enjoy superb coffee and opt for lobster with a twist. It's vegan lobster. Oblo Bar and Bistro offers more seafood, followed by the excellent Gia Patsy's ice cream from the sister business downstairs. My suitably fishy last supper is a fried seafood platter at the Contented Soul. My departure from Eyemouth is suitably dramatic too, as I weave under Big Borders skies up the Berwickshire coastal path in search of St. Abbs. In this picturesque wee village, New Asgard and Marvel, I meet Mark Nicol of Discover Scottish Borders. He guides me to St. Abbs Head. As the scenery goes into overdrive, we catch sight of a seal pup and then a pod of galloping bottlenose dolphins, all enjoying the voluntary Berwickshire Marine Reserve, the only one of its kind in Scotland. Mark beams. The Borders are Scotland's unsung star attraction, and the Berwickshire coast is a huge part of that appeal. I don't need convincing. Edward I must be turning in his grave. Travel tip of the week. Trail crazy. Southern Scotland is crisscrossed by an ever-increasing treasure trove of long-distance walking and cycling trails. I've walked swathes of the coast-to-coast Southern Upland Way, most of the Borders Abbeys Way, and a large tract of the cross-border St Cuthbert's Way, and every section trampled has been glorious. On the cycling front, this year we'll see proper signage go up on the new Kirkpatrick coast-to-coast. So get your boots on or your bike out. By Robin McElvey, The National, recorded on Tuesday, 30th of January 2024. The Culture Section. Exclusive. Scottish food and drink to be stocked in New London Shop. By Adam Robertson, multimedia journalist. A new shop, which prides itself as being 100% Scottish, is set to open in London to help celebrate and promote suppliers from across the country. Greg Boyd, 30, is the founder of Alltag, a company with the core mission of championing Scottish produce, which is set to open its new store, The Shop, in Angel in London next week. Originally from Kirkintilloch, Boyd's interest in food and drink started when he was a youngster. He spoke with The National about his journey from starting the business in lockdown to preparing to open his new store. Developing an interest. Boyd admits that he only discovered his interest in food and drink by chance after an incident as a teenager. The truthful story is, like some kids, I was in the park, underage, having an alcoholic drink, and my mum grounded me for the whole summer, he explained. It meant that all I watched was cooking shows like Jamie, Oliver, at home. I had a garden as a kid, but never used it, and watched him growing his vegetables, getting the lamb locally, and became fascinated by it because I hadn't really experienced it as a kid. When it got to Christmas that year, I spent my money on cooking kit and got it into learning about it all. Despite considering a career in food straight away, Boyd ended up going to university but always retained part-time jobs in the food and drink industry. I worked in a farm shop with a real focus on Scottish produce and became obsessed with that element. It might seem quite basic to some people, but it was unbelievable to me. A change of career. Following his move to London, Boyd initially worked as an economist, but the idea for Alltag had been around for some time. When it first started, it operated more as a delivery service for people looking to get their haggis, neeps and tatties. Boyd explained, "My career was going well, but the more I went into it, the less chance I had to set this up. Lockdown came along and I was stuck inside, so it was now or never at that point, really. People would order it on the website and I would drop it off to them, which was a real experiment, to be honest. As time went on, I went to markets and got myself a gazebo and basic outdoor cooking kit. As his success grew, Boyd was eventually given the chance to work as the resident chef at a brewery in Walthamstow. When I got to the end of that period, it was about March last year, so I came back to the crossroads of my old career in either going for it or getting the shop set up. I want to give suppliers a chance around Scotland, which nobody seems to know about, but I know are brilliant, he said. Setting up shop. Boyd says he's planning on opening the new store to the public next Friday, and there will be a wide range of classic Scottish produce to choose from. This includes cheese from Inverness to Mull, smoked fish from East Nuke, beer and charcuterie from Edinburgh, and much more. It's 100% Scottish, even the flour we use is from North Berwick. I've tried to go down to the foundations to make it that way, Boyd said. We'll bake our morning rolls in-house because they don't travel particularly well to Scotland. We'll have Scotch pies, Mother's Pride-style bread for our sandwiches. Our milk is coming from Scotland. There's two elements, the cafe and the deli. The cafe gives people that real taste of home that they miss. We've got an alcohol licence too, so you can get some Scottish cider. We want to show the breadth of Scottish food and drink capabilities. Having lived in London for more than a decade now, Boyd is excited to get the store up and running. He said, every year when I lived here during my old career, I'd always wonder it must be happening this year. I was very surprised, but I'm glad I've managed to push it myself and bring it to London. People always ask me about Scottish food and say, is that a deep-fried Mars bar? And it always made me sigh. So this is part excitement, but also part frustration to showcase all this. All these little mini missions are part of the journey. It's not about being bitter and annoyed, but saying, look what we have, come and enjoy it all here. By Adam Robertson, The National, recorded on Wednesday, 31st of January, 2024. The Culture Section. Scottish comedian Fern Brady picks up prize at Cafe Nero Awards. By Lucy Jackson, multimedia journalist. A Scottish comedian is one of four authors who have picked up awards at the inaugural Nero Book Awards. The winners will receive £5,000 each, and the yet-to-be-announced overall victor will take home the Book of the Year title and an additional £30,000. Fern Brady, known for appearing on TV game show Taskmaster, won in the non-fiction category for her memoir Strong Female Character, which details her experience being diagnosed with autism. The awards, launched by high street coffee chain Cafe Nero in 2023, celebrates the craft of writing, and four category winners were chosen by 12 judges who selected books from the UK and Ireland over the last 12 months. Responding to the news on Twitter, stroke X, Brady said she'd won a proper book prize for proper people. Speaking in the BBC Radio 4 Today programme, Brady said, that's the really embarrassing part now, because I was really honest in the book, and now it feels like everyone is seeing my bare bum, except it's the bum of my soul. Alongside Brady, Dublin-born author Paul Murray won the fiction category for The Bee Sting, which follows an Irish family facing financial and emotional troubles. His novel was also shortlisted for the 2023 Booker Prize, but he was beaten by fellow Irish writer Paul Lynch, who won with Prophet Song. The winner of the Nero Children's Fiction category is Newcastle-based writer Beth Lincoln for murder mystery The Swifts, illustrated by Claire Powell. Northern Irish author Michael McGee won the debut fiction prize for Close to Home, which details the story of a young man who comes home to Belfast after university and has to grapple with the aftermath of an assault he commits at a party. One of these four books will be selected as the overall winner and recipient of the Nero Gold Prize Book of the Year, which will be announced at a ceremony on March 14. A final judging panel, led by Bernardine Evaristo, who was joint winner of the Booker Prize in 2019 with Girl, Woman, Other, will select the overall winner. Jerry Ford, founder and group chief executive of Cafe Nero, said, "The Nero Book Awards are a hugely important part of our programme to sponsor the arts and support creative excellence. The four winning books represent the very best writing from the UK and Ireland, and we're proud at Cafe Nero to create a platform that celebrates homegrown talent and to offer a total prize pot of £50,000. Our judges have selected four brilliant books that will appeal to readers of all tastes. My congratulations to the winning authors, and thank you to our judges, partners and the wider publishing industry for engaging with these awards so enthusiastically in our first year. It's our goal that these awards come to represent a badge of exceptional quality, which is seen as aspirational for authors and within the industry and a trustworthy recommendation for readers." By Lucy Jackson.
The National News on Wednesday, the 31st of January. Fewer smokers are trying to quit. An article issued by the National News Desk. Smokers in Scotland made fewer attempts to give up their habit last year, with the number of quit attempts falling for the 11th consecutive year. Figures show there were 26,954 quit attempts made with the help of NHS Stop Smoking Services in Scotland in 2022-2023, down 14.1% from the previous year's total of 31,365. The number of attempts was 77.8% lower than the peak year for smokers to try to give up in 2011-2012, when there were 121,385 attempts. The figures come in a report from Public Health Scotland. It said smoking remains a major cause of poor health in Scotland. The Scottish Government wants to cut the number of people who smoke to just 5% by 2034. The 2022 Scottish Health Survey found that 18% of men and 13% of women were smokers. Of the 26,594 quit attempts made with the NHS support in the last year, 12,444, or 46.2%, reported that they were still not smoking after 4 weeks, and 8,119, or 30.1%, after 12 weeks. A Scottish Government spokesperson said, "Stopping smoking is one of the best things people can do for their health, and it's important that people have access to the right support at the right time." An article issued by the National News Desk. The National News on Wednesday, the 31st of January. Healthcare robots pass the test in hospital trials. An article written by Lucy Garcia. Robots developed by a world-leading centre based in Scotland to help in healthcare environments have been tested successfully by experts. The Spring units will be used to assist patients, alleviate their anxiety and relieve pressure on nursing staff as part of a trial conducted in Paris by staff from the UK's National Robotarium. The Robotarium is a partnership between Heriot Watt University and the University of Edinburgh. The robots have artificial intelligence and are said to be capable of natural conversations to understand patient needs and assist with routine tasks. The trials took place in three phases at the Assistance Publique Hospitaux de Paris. The robots greeted patients, answered questions, provided directions, and were able to understand conversations involving multiple people at the same time. By carrying out simple but repetitive duties, they reduced potential physical contact between clinicians and patients, with early feedback suggesting the use of the robots may lower infection transmission risk while boosting productivity of nurses and doctors. Professor Anne-Sophie Rigaud, head of department at the French hospital, said, "Our patients are increasingly interested in robotics and the evolution of hospital services, which they see as the logical evolution of our society. We believe that the robot could in future become an essential element of patient care in hospitals, thanks to its capacity for social interaction and guidance." Older adults expressed that they're pleased with the design of the robot and thought it would be useful to provide information and companionship to patients with cognitive disorders. The Robotarium is funded through the £1.5 billion Edinburgh and South East Scotland City Region deal. It's supported by £300 million in funding from the Scottish Government and £300 million from the UK Government. Oliver Lemon, a Professor of AI and Academic Co-Lead at the National Robotarium, said, "Today's rapid advances in AI are truly inspiring and open up a world of possibilities for its positive impact on various sectors, including healthcare. One of the most significant contributions of robotics and AI is its ability to conserve resources and alleviate human workload, therefore providing valuable new tools for enhancing healthcare delivery. The prospect of robots seamlessly collaborating with hospital staff to enhance the patient experience is now closer to reality. Promising initial trials at the Assistance Publique Hospitaux de Paris have demonstrated our robot's ability to converse effectively with patients and their companions simultaneously. We believe the project marks a significant milestone in the development of interactive robotics, and we're proud of its achievements, while recognising the exciting challenges that lie ahead." Neil Gray, the Scottish Government's Wellbeing, Economy, Fair Work and Energy Secretary, said, I welcome this progress using artificial intelligence to help ease the pressure on health service staff. With Scottish Government support, the National Robotarium is using cutting-edge research to help drive innovation and artificial intelligence to deliver creative solutions to real-world challenges. Malcolm Offord, UK Government Minister for Scotland, said, "The early trials successfully demonstrate the great potential such advanced technology has to deliver vital support to health staff, improve patient care, and prevent the spread of infections and diseases." An article written by Lucy Garcia. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 31st of January. MSPs back motion saying that Scotland's future is best served in the EU. An article written by James Walker. MSPs have backed a motion saying that Scotland's future is best served by being part of the EU. External Affairs Secretary Angus Robertson led a Scottish Parliament debate on Tuesday in which MSPs backed a motion that affirmed that Scotland's economic, social and political future is best served by being part of the EU. The motion passed with 64 votes in favour and 49 against, with one abstention. Mr Robertson also invited Parliament to note the proposals in the Scottish Government paper, An Independent Scotland in the EU, the seventh paper in the Building a New Scotland series. It comes after poll analysis showed most Scots believe leaving the UK and joining the EU would be better for the country. Analysis by expert Alex Scholes, writing for Professor Sir John Curtis's blog What Scotland Thinks, showed almost every outcome was framed positively for Scotland being an independent country in the EU. Mr Scholes said the poll, conducted last summer, made it clear that Brexit and EU membership would be a key issue at any future independence referendum for Scotland. Speaking ahead of the debate, Mr Robertson cited analysis by Cambridge Econometrics, which has explored the economic impact of the UK leaving the customs union and single market, compared to if the UK had stayed in the EU. He said, "The Scottish Parliament repeatedly expressed its support for remaining in the EU and the single market, and yet the people of Scotland and their elected Parliament were ignored time and time again. Today's debate is an opportunity for this Parliament to affirm that Scotland's economic, social and political future is best served by being part of the EU." According to the National Institute of Economic and Social Research, the UK economy is 2.5% smaller as a result of Brexit, equating to a cut of around £2.3 billion in public revenues for Scotland. Cambridge Econometrics estimates this damage will continue and reach 10% of gross value added by 2035. After 4 years of limited economic growth, restricted trade, record food price inflation and diminished opportunities for young people, the evidence is clear that Brexit isn't working, as the Mayor of London, Sadiq Khan, recently said. An article written by James Walker. The National. News. On Wednesday, the 31st of January. Scottish councillors opt not to name any project after Queen Elizabeth. An article written by Gregor Young. A Scottish city will not name any projects after the late Queen Elizabeth, councillors have decided. Aberdeen Council's Finance and Resources Committee decided that there were no suitable projects to name after the late monarch, the Press and Journal reported. Queen Elizabeth died at her private estate in Balmoral in Aberdeenshire in September of 2022. Five options had been earmarked by officials as potential projects to take the late monarch's name after Tory plans to name Union Terrace Gardens in her honour were not taken forward. The options were the replacement Hazelhead Academy, the new play park at Hazelhead Park, the proposed new primary school at New Hills, the new Riverbank Primary School and the new urban park at Aberdeen Beach. Whichever project was chosen, the committee agenda stated that it was expected that the cost of the renaming will be accommodated within existing budgets. At a meeting on January the 30th, Councillors had been due to consider the option for capital projects that could be named after Queen Elizabeth II. Note the process for naming a capital project after Queen Elizabeth II and agree which project to be named after Queen Elizabeth II. However, councillors on the Resources Committee said none of the projects were suitable. The option of naming a development project after the late monarch remains open moving forward. While the council will review each year whether any projects could be named after the late monarch, councillors agreed that the public should be given a say before any final decisions are made. An article written by Gregor Young. The National. Politics. On Wednesday, the 31st of January. Irish unity within touching distance, with Stormont return. An article written by Judith Duffy. The leader of Sinn Féin said yesterday that the return of government at Stormont will be a moment of very great significance, with Irish unity now within touching distance. The power-sharing deal in Northern Ireland could be back up and running within days after the Democratic Unionist Party, or DUP, endorsed a deal for it to be restored after a 23-month absence. Sinn Féin's Michelle O'Neill will become First Minister when it is restored in a first for the party after it became the largest party in the Northern Ireland Assembly in the elections in 2022. Sinn Féin party leader Mary Lou MacDonald told reporters the return of a functioning assembly had been a long time coming. She said, "We are almost 2 years away from the last assembly election. I very much welcome the fact that the DUP has now moved to explicitly recognise and respect the outcome of that assembly election. We look forward now to getting the job done, getting ministers in place, having MLAs return to the chamber and Michelle O'Neill taking up position as First Minister. That will be a moment of very great significance, not simply because we haven't had government for so long, but because it will be the first time that we will have had a Sinn Féin First Minister, a Nationalist First Minister. So a mark of the extent of change that has occurred in the North and indeed right across Ireland." Ms. MacDonald also spoke about the potential for Irish unity, saying, "The historical turning of the wheel and the electoral place we are at, I think, signifies that what we talk about is possible now. As a matter of fact, in historic terms, it is within touching distance, and I think that's a very exciting thing, and I hope people will find that a very welcoming conversation." The end of the two-year Stormont impasse was signalled in the early hours of yesterday morning when DUP leader Geoffrey Donaldson secured the backing of his party executive for UK government proposals aimed at addressing concerns over Brexit's so-called Irish Sea border. He hailed a new agreement on the movement of some goods into Northern Ireland, as he said people are already beginning to see the benefits of the deal his party has struck with the UK government. Mr. Donaldson also predicted the Green Lane element created in the Windsor framework will go, as he expressed hope that the Stormont power-sharing institutions can be restored within days. Northern Ireland Secretary Chris Heaton-Harris said he believed that all the conditions are now in place for Stormont to return. The UK government said it will now publish proposals to secure Northern Ireland's place in the UK internal market and to strengthen the union. Ms. MacDonald said her party had no concerns over the deal, which she said had been reached after painstaking work. She said, "We've been in close contact with both governments and indeed with Brussels. We are satisfied that no part of the Good Friday Agreement has been undermined or damaged. We also know that Brussels, Dublin, all parties are satisfied that what's been agreed stays between the hedges of Brussels and the European market, and also the concerns that the DUP expressed. All of that has been accommodated and worked on painstakingly." However, the DUP's return to Stormont is dependent on the UK government implementing the various legislative assurances and other measures it has offered. It is understood it will introduce two statutory instruments at Westminster to give legislative effect to the commitments it has made on trade and sovereignty. The return of Stormont will also see the Treasury release a £3.3 billion package to support under-pressure public services in Northern Ireland. The financial package includes money to settle the demands of striking public sector workers this year. The DUP has been using a veto power to block Stormont's devolved institutions for 2 years in protest at the post-Brexit arrangements that have created trade barriers between Great Britain and Northern Ireland. Meanwhile, Prime Minister Rishi Sunak told Irish Premier Leo Varadkar that he was confident the latest developments in Northern Ireland paved the way for the restoration of power sharing. A Downing Street spokesperson said the Prime Minister spoke to the Taoiseach today to update him on the UK government's negotiations with the DUP and Northern Ireland parties following last night's positive step from the DUP. However, support for the deal is not unanimous within the DUP, and several senior figures remain fiercely opposed to the proposed agreement to restore power sharing. An article written by Judith Duffy.
From The National, Thursday the 1st of February. From the news section. Believe in Scotland announces date for Glasgow Independence March. Article by Laura Pollock. Believe in Scotland, BIS, has announced the date of its first march and rally of 2024. The campaign group will host the event in Glasgow alongside Pensioners for Independence, with the theme, Independence to End Pensioner Poverty. The action follows BIS's first ever march and rally, which was held in September 2023. It was attended by thousands, with Hamza Yousaf making his first appearance speaking at an independence rally as First Minister. The Glasgow demonstration will be held on Saturday, April the 20th. More details on speakers will be released shortly, the group stated, with the hope that events will have a Festival of Independence feel. BIS's march in Edinburgh late this year will host it again with Yes for EU. The founder of BIS, Gordon McIntyre Kemp, said, "Activists don't complain, we campaign." He said, "Our events are more about celebrating Scottish culture and positivity than about politics. Our rallies are designed to rally the troops and talk Scotland up. We don't complain, we campaign." Another thing that makes our march and rallies unique is the partnerships we form with other independence campaign groups. In Glasgow, we are partnering with our friends at Pensioners for Independence, with the rally theme being how independence can end pensioner poverty. The campaign umbrella group currently has 142 local and national pro-independence groups working with them. Participants in the Glasgow march are asked to gather on Kelvin Way to set off at 12:30 p.m, marching into the city centre of Glasgow with the rally taking place in George Square. Supporters of Yes can register their interest at www.believeinscotland.org/Glasgow_march_rally. In that article written by Laura Pollock. From The National, Thursday the 1st of February, from the news section. Scottish man guilty of illegally selling peregrine falcon chicks. Article by Gregor Young. A Scottish man has been ordered to pay thousands of pounds in fines after pleading guilty to illegally selling chicks of the fastest bird on earth. Gary McFarlane from Blackridge in West Lothian has to pay more than £7,000 after admitting to advertising and selling peregrine falcon chicks without the required legal documentation. Peregrine falcons, a species that is native to Scotland, can reach speeds of 242 mph when in a diving stoop. They're a protected species, but they're not considered endangered. McFarlane, 61, pleaded guilty to advertising and selling peregrine falcon chicks without the required legal documentation under the Control of Trade and Endangered Species Regulations 2018. He appeared at Livingston Sheriff Court for sentencing on Thursday, February the 1st, and was fined £2,100. McFarlane previously pleaded guilty to 11 charges at a hearing at Livingston Sheriff Court on October the 26th, 2023. The 61-year-old was ordered to forfeit £5,220 in cash, which had been seized from his home address. The charges included 4 counts of advertising and selling peregrine falcons without Article 10 certificates being issued, which is a requirement under the legislation for selling such protected species. He also admitted 7 counts of making false declarations in terms of the parent lineage of the chicks. Detective Constable Stephen Irwin of the National Wildlife Crime Unit said, This case sends a strong message to those who flout regulations in terms of our endangered and protected species, that Police Scotland will thoroughly investigate these crimes and bring those responsible to justice. Gary McFarlane sold protected chicks for his own profit and under false pretences, which led to an extensive police investigation involving significant support from partner organisations, including the SSPCA, the Scottish Government's SASA Forensic Unit, the Animal Plant Health Agency, the National Wildlife Crime Unit, and Raptor Specialists. Members of the public have a vital role to play in tackling wildlife crime, and I would encourage anyone with information or concerns about this type of criminality to contact Police Scotland on 101 or Crime Stoppers anonymously on 0800 555 111. And that article was written by Gregor Young and read today by me, Ian. From The National, Thursday the 1st of February. News. Scottish police issue appeal after horror bus crash death. Article by James Walker. Police have issued an appeal after the death of a pedestrian who was hit by a bus in Glasgow. The 64-year-old man was struck by the bus at 7:30 a.m. on January the 27th on Great Western Road, near the junction with Horslet Hill Road. He was pronounced dead at the scene. Officers are keen to speak with the driver of a blue-grey VW Charan or Touran taxi, which was travelling on Great Western Road. Police say the driver may have witnessed the horror bus crash or could have dashcam footage that it could assist with inquiries. Road Policing Sergeant Scott Gurley said, "Extensive inquiries remain ongoing to establish the full circumstances of this crash. Think back, were you in that area that day and did you see what happened? If so, please get in touch. Our thoughts remain with the family and friends of the man who has died. Our officers will continue to support them." Anyone with information is urged to contact Police Scotland on 101, quoting reference 0766 of January 27th. And that article was by James Walker. From The National, Thursday the 1st of February, from the news section, Scottish shopping centre bought for undisclosed sum. Article by Nicole Mitchell. A Scottish city centre shopping centre has been bought by property investors for an undisclosed sum. Aimcore, a commercial property and investment collective, have purchased the Prince's Square retail development in Glasgow. It features four self-contained retail units along Buchanan Street and an inner mall spread across five levels. Occupants of the shopping centre include Levi's, Michael Kors, Sweaty Betty and Everyman Cinema. LCP, part of Aimcore, has been appointed to manage Prince's Square. James Buchanan, LCP Group Managing Director, said, "The acquisition of Prince's Square is a fitting start to 2024. Situated in the heart of Glasgow, it boasts significant retail, food and leisure brands. With our proven track record in focused investment and intensive asset management, we are poised to capitalise on market opportunities, enhance value and provide excellent offerings for our tenants." Roddy Proudfoot, LCP Director, Head of Scotland Office, said, "Buchanan Street is a renowned retail and leisure destination with an annual footfall exceeding 52 million and offers significant potential. We are already engaged in discussions with high-profile potential retail and restaurant occupiers, including new entrants to the Glasgow market, and look forward to making announcements in the coming weeks." The five-storey Grade B listed building dates back to the 1840s and was recognised in 2016 as Scotland's best building of the last century by the Royal Incorporation of Architects in Scotland. Prince's Square has been contacted for comment. Prince's Square is located at 48 Buchanan Street, Glasgow. An article was written by Nicole Mitchell. From The National, Thursday the 1st of February, from the politics section, Tories accused of scapegoating migrants with new housing policy. Article by Laura Pollock. The Tories have been accused of using migrants as scapegoats for the UK housing emergency, with deeply worrying language suggesting housing will go to British people who work hard. In a post on social media, the Conservative Party official account posted a graphic with the words British Homes for British People. Another slogan stated, "We're ensuring decent hard-working people are prioritised for the home they need." The caption read, "We are making sure the allocation of social housing is fairer for people in cracking down on rule breakers." The post came after reports in late January that Downing Street is considering a British Homes for British Workers scheme to give UK families higher priority for social housing. According to The Guardian, officials are preparing to launch a consultation within weeks into how British citizens can be given faster access to social housing. The post caused outrage with Twitter/X users, including a post from Shelter, the UK's leading housing charity. It called out the post's deeply worrying language as a way to blame migrants for failings in society and hide genuine government failure. The organisation said, "This is deeply worrying language that has historically been used to blame migrants for failings in society and to divide people and communities. It's a smokescreen designed to cover up the government's own failure to tackle the housing emergency. Hashtag social housing not scapegoating." It added, "As the general election approaches, we expect to hear more and more calls stigmatising people who weren't born here." Another user wrote, "We see you Tories very well now and know your old tricks," with others suggesting the party avoid building houses. One wrote, "Maybe just work to make regular housing affordable and crack down on parasitic landlords and buy out to-let schemes. Just a thought, lads." Number 10 in the Department for Levelling Up, Housing and Communities both previously declined to comment on what they called policy speculation. The Prime Minister is striving to be seen as tough on immigration after legal net levels hit record highs under the Tories, and he struggles to get his Rwanda policy for illegal crossings accepted. Amid dire polling for the Conservatives, Rishi Sunak is wary of losing votes to the right-wing Reform UK party, as well as to Labour. Polly Neat, the chief executive of the Shelter Housing Charity, described the proposal as divisive and depressing, and nothing more than scapegoating at its worst. "It is unnecessary, unenforceable and unjust," she said. Not only does it ignore the fact that there are already stringent rules so only UK citizens or those with settled status can access homes for social rent, but it blames a group of people for a housing emergency that they did not create. And that article was written by Laura Pollock.
This is from The National. On Thursday, 1st February 2024. From the Culture section. Scotland's richest man offers the traitor's experience in Highlands. By Ross Hunter. The conservation-focused estates firm owned by Scotland's richest man is offering the traitors-like experiences at its Highland properties. Ander Hallpolson's company, Wildland, which manages his 220,000 acres of property across 13 estates in Scotland, is set to offer experiences similar to those seen in the hit BBC show across its range of castles, lodges and guest houses. Amongst the properties available are Aldoorie Castle on the shores of Loch Ness and Glenfeshie Lodge, which sits in one of Scotland's most ambitious rewilding projects. Wildland say they are offering activities such as clay pigeon shooting contests, wild swimming, or a day aboard the Wildland boat exploring hidden caves and private islands. A percentage of every booking goes towards funding Wildland's 200-year vision for the landscape, which includes restoring ancient peatland and re-establishing native woodland lost by overgrazing by deer. Rates start at £425 per night, including food and board. It comes after Wildland reported a multi-million pound loss in the year ending July 2023, with pre-tax losses amounting to £9.3 million. Polson, who made his fortune through clothing chain bestseller and fashion retailer ASOS, is an ardent supporter of rewilding and is Scotland's largest landowner. In 2024, work is due to begin on a £10.5 million care home and GP surgery in the Highland village of Tongue, funded by Wildland. The firm struck a deal with NHS Highland and Highland Council, who will rent the building back from Wildland when it's completed. That article was by Ross Hunter.
That concludes this week's edition of the National Podcast. Please remember to subscribe to our channels at Hume Review and tell your friends about our service.